Tea and Jeopardy with Emma Newman. There's always time for a nice cup of tea and a spot of mild peril. Well, hello there, my lovelies. I do hope you're well, and that your day hasn't been spoiled by a version of yourself from an alternate timeline. My name is Emma Newman, and I'd like to welcome you into my secret tea there for polite conversation, abject geekery, a cheeky bit of cake, and, of course, a nice cup of tea. We'll be taking to the air today on the back of these magnificent giant birds. So if you'll climb up the wing of the one nearest to you and seat yourself on the howdah, that would be splendid. The seats are very comfortable, and there are jewelled seat belts so that you'll feel secure once we take to the air. I hope you don't have any allergies to feathers. I've been reassured that it tends not to be a problem with birds of this size. This flock has been loaned to us from a rather dashing fellow who's a friend of a chap called Sinbad. He's disgustingly rich, hence the luxurious silks of the howdah canopies and the lovely fat tassels hanging from them. We're just waiting for my guest to arrive, and once she does, we'll take to the air. Once we're up there, it will be quite windy, so do make use of the marvellous ear trumpets positioned next to each seat. Latimer spent all morning securing those into place, and we wouldn't want him to feel it was in vain.
I'm sorry to disturb you, ma'am, but your guest has arrived, a Mrs. Mary Robinette Cole.
You look a little flushed, Latimer. Are you well?
It's the card, ma'am. Look at it.
Oh, very nice. It's a lovely heavy cream stock, cold-pressed for the extra tooth. I do like the etched motif of vine-wrapped lattice in the corners. Mary Robinette Cole. I always appreciate an elegant copper plate. And there in the lower left corner, it further says Mrs. Robert A. Cole, Chicago. I can't see why you're so flustered. It's a beautiful card.
But look at the upper right corner, ma'am. It's turned down to indicate that the lady herself has called, rather than sending a servant. It's been such a long time since we had a guest who knew the proper etiquette.
Are you going to cry, Latimer?
Just a speck of dust in my eye, ma'am. I'll help Mrs. Cole from the carriage and bring her up.
For those of you who don't know, Mary Robinette Cole is an author, audiobook narrator, puppeteer and podcaster. She's the author of the Glamorist Histories series, published by Tor, has won the John W. Campbell Award for Best New Writer, and the Hugo Award for Best Short Story, and the Hugo for Best Related Work, as part of the podcasting team on Writing Excuses.
Mrs. Mary Robinette Cole, ma'am.
Hello, Mary. Do come and sit down. How are you?
Very well, thank you. This is astonishing.
Thank you, yes. Latimer does have some very interesting friends. Would you like a cup of tea?
Oh, yes, thank you.
And how do you take it?
Usually with cream and sugar.
Wonderful. And would you like a nice plump bath bun to go with it?
Oh, I would just so much. I've never actually had one, although I've read about them quite a bit. They're not so common in the U.S.
They are extraordinarily sugary.
Good heavens.
And, yes, a little bit crumbly as well. Excellent. So I sent an invitation, as you know, and asked if you would bring a curio with you. And I was wondering what you've decided to bring. We're taking off.
Oh, good heavens. Wow. That was a little swifter than I thought it would be.
Yes. I'm glad that was holding on to the tea set.
Oh, right. Sorry.
So the curio. I was wondering what curio you've brought with you today.
Well, I brought this tiny wind-up squirrel, which I quite love. It's my family has been collecting wind-up toys for years, so I love the little tin body and the fact that it has this ridiculous fluffy tail attached to the tin body that cracks me up, especially the way it bounces when it hops. Do you want to see it hop?
Yes, I'd love to.
I think it's okay on the... So the wind is not as bad as I thought. It's a very cleverly shaped howdah.
Yes, it's very good.
Okay, so here's my little guy.
That's cool. gorgeous.
I just love him so much.
Does he have a name?
No, although he's been in some of my shows, but I've never named him. Poor thing.
The squirrel with no name. Da-da-da. So, I know, and I should imagine that a huge proportion of my listeners know that you're a writer, an audiobook narrator, and a puppeteer, which is a splendid triumvirate of skills. But I was wondering if you have a talent that's less well known about.
Well, I feel like they're all sort of related. I mean, I was an art major in college, so I draw and I paint. Very rarely do I show those anymore. And then I sing.
Wow.
Again, because of the theater. It's all very tightly related.
Mm. Do you ever draw? I suppose you draw the puppets, like the ones that you were showing us at Worldcon. Do you make a lot of them?
Mm-hmm. I do. It's all about diversifying the income stream, really. I build and perform. Sometimes I do just design and then I hand the drawing to someone else to make. That's fairly rare. But I do the whole package, really. Most of the drawing that I do these days is where I'm designing a puppet. Although, if you look in some of the weird tales when I was the art director, every now and then you'll spot, and Shimmer magazine, you'll spot one where an artist dropped, didn't come through, and if you look for B.F. Smith, that was my artist pseudonym.
Oh, wonderful. That's excellent. I mean, I remember various tweets over the past year or two where you'll say, I'm just about to go and make some entrails. And there's always a, what? Oh, no, it's okay. It's probably a puppet thing. It is just a puppet thing, isn't it?
Oh, yes, of course. There's absolutely nothing untoward going on at any point. Entirely innocent.
If you could puppet anyone in the world for one day, who would it be and why?
Oh, good heavens. Boy, that would be, first of all, that would be fairly messy, because you just have to put your hand in really unmentionable places.
Oh, no, let's use some nice, clean and polite magic that just enables you to wave your hands so they do what you wish without any need for internal cavities.
I suppose it would probably wind up being someone in politics on the day of an important vote.
Yes.
Because really, if you're going to use your power, why not use it for good? You know, if we could get healthcare passed and like firmly stable in the U.S., that would make me very happy. So, I probably shouldn't tell you who I'm going to do this to, since that might spoil my secret plans.
Ah, yes. Yes, that's a very good point. Well, let's move on quickly, lest terrible things be revealed.
Yes.
So, I asked on the Twitters if there was anything that anyone would like to ask you, and Mike Underwood asked a question which leaped out at me, because you recently narrated Celebromancy for him, I believe.
I did. I love that book.
And he's such a lovely chap as well.
He so is. He's just a dear.
He really is. And he asked how you make the decision on choosing the vocal tone for different characters when you're performing audiobooks.
Oh, well, it's a combination of things. The first thing I look for is if the author has supplied any clues in the text. Sometimes the author has specified, you know, a husky voice or a higher voice or sometimes an accent. So that's the first clue. Frequently, authors don't describe voices, which then leaves it up to me. Mm. At that point, I look at how often the character is going to be speaking. And if it's going to be quite a lot, then I want to make sure that it's a voice that is sustainable and easily distinct from other characters. I also have what I call my red shirt voices, which are the throwaways, the ones that I'm going to use for one line of dialogue, and I don't need to be able to sustain it, and it doesn't need to be distinct from anyone else.
Mm-hmm. I had the pleasure of visiting your house after Worldcon in Chicago, And one of my happy memories, there are many happy memories from that afternoon.
That was lovely.
It was lovely, and it has nothing to do with the zombie cocktails that you were making us. What were those called?
The Corpse Reviver number 2.
Ah, yes, that's it. There's an example of semantic memory. Yes, the Corpse Reviver.
Number 2, it's important because it's very different from the Corpse Reviver number 1, which is a brandy-based cocktail, and Corpse Reviver number 2 is a gin-based cocktail.
Well, you see, that surprises me because I went to a gin appreciation session at a convention recently and discovered that I really do not like gin, but I enjoy the Corpse Reviver, so thank goodness for cocktails masking things that we don't actually like.
That's true.
Now, one of the things I remember from that splendid afternoon was enjoying your collection of vintage typewriters.
I did think about bringing a typewriter with me today, but they are so bulky to travel with.
Yes, rather heavy, I should imagine. I was wondering which one is your favourite and why.
Currently, and it changes, my current favourite is a Smith Corona number 3, which is a folding typewriter. And these were very popular during the First World War. They fold down to be more compact, so they were reporters' typewriters. They're quite light. I think they weigh about 2 or 3 pounds, surprisingly light. This one is green, which is just kind of delightful, and not like an army green. This is sort of brilliant emerald green. And the thing that I particularly like about this one is that it has a special keyboard, and that is the actual name. It's the special keyboard, which it has a few more keys and also has mathematical symbols on it.
Ah.
So instead of just your numbers, you also have pi, you have the division bracket, you have square root, you actually have fractions all built in. It's a lovely thing.
And could the owner use different keyboards? You said that was like the special one. Were there different ones that you could buy, and were they interchangeable, or did you just have to choose that particular model?
You just had to choose that particular model. I did see one where you could swap out the keys, but I have no understanding of how that would have actually worked. It just seems ridiculously complicated. The Blickendurfer number 9, I think it is, but the Blickendurfer was an old rotary ball typewriter, which predates the IBM Selectric by about 70 years. So this was in the 1890s, and you could actually take the type head off, because it was a ball, and put a different type head on, which would give you different fonts.
Oh, wow.
It's quite the fancy thing.
I loved it because one of the things that it made me appreciate is how divorced we are from how the movement of our fingers produces the type on the page now, that we, you know, strike a keyboard, it appears on the screen, and then something dark and mysterious happens inside a printer, and then it's there. Whereas when you're in front of a typewriter and you strike each key, you see the physical mechanism making that thing reality. Is that one of the things that appeals to you?
Very much so, that it is a completely understandable mechanism. One of the things that I actually wind up doing sometimes when I'm discovering that I'm bogging down or dragging on a scene is that sometimes I'll switch from computer to typewriter or to longhand, just because the mechanical differences, I think, cause my brain to fire in slightly different ways, which I find very interesting.
That is interesting. I used to write longhand, and I've never gone back, but I wonder what would happen. Well, actually, I'm quite fearful of what would happen. What terrible things could arise if I started to write in longhand and summon a Cthulhoid entity or something awful. Not that I'm a worrier.
Ooh, I bet these rocks would make amazing quills, although maybe for bold writing.
Yes, I think so. Now, there was something that somebody else asked on the Twitters, and I was quite intrigued by it. And they said to ask you about your horrific wrist injury because puppets are vicious creatures. Heavens, what happened?
Okay, well, this is a horrific story. It's funny because people think of puppets as being very cute, and they can be, but if you're doing a show like Little Shop of Horrors, the largest puppet weighs anywhere between 80 to 125 pounds.
Good grief.
So I was doing a production of Little Shop. I've done 7 different productions, and this was a 3-month run. And the weekend before we closed, we had a stunt go a little bit wrong. So basically what was supposed to happen was that I was supposed to lift the puppet off the ground, snap at Seymour, set it down, and then he would punch the puppet. And he punched it too soon, so he punched it while it was still in the air, and I attempted to control it as it was shearing to the side, and something in my wrist popped. And it is the horrific story. And I knew that something was horribly wrong, and so I shifted my grip, because we were very close to the end of the show. And, finished the show. It was a two-show day. So I had a break between shows. We iced it. We wrapped it. I was very careful. I switched all of my positions so that I wasn't putting... So that my left hand was dominant. It was my right hand that the popping happened in. And continued the did the second show. Because, adrenaline and the show must go on, and I was a little bit of an idiot. And I also knew that I was going to have 3 days off before I had to do the show again. So I took those 3 days off, just babied my wrist. And the moment I got back into the puppet, it was clear that I had done something horribly, horribly wrong to my arm. And got out of the puppet, went straight to the emergency room. And I had a doctor that the first doctor was, I think, stoned, because he kept going, "Well, dude, and these repetitive use injuries." I'm like, "Did you hear the part about impact and a popping sensation? these repetitive..." I'm like, so they sent me to a hand specialist, and, well, actually, first they sent me to a different doctor who thought it was a cyst, because it was very, very localized swelling. And there was a hard raised knob under my...
is it a dislocation?
No. They thought that it was a localized sprain, and so I was put into physical therapy. And what it turned out to be was that I had torn a ligament, and in the physical therapy basically spent a month and a half re-tearing it every day.
Oh, no!
So I wound up in a cast for about a year. And then spent another year doing physical therapy to get full range of motion back.
My goodness, that is genuinely horrific.
Yeah, it really, it was not good times. It was also, I had met the man I was going to marry, although I didn't know it at the time. I met him 2 weeks before this incident. So for the first year we were dating, I had this, I had a cast on.
That is such a strange parallel, because I met my husband-to-be at the time, very shortly, a comparable amount of time, actually, before I went to France and got far too excited at the sight of the sea and fell and gashed my knees open and sprained my ankle and then returned to England unable to walk properly very, very early in the relationship. So,
funny.
So yes. Similar ways to find a keeper, yeah. It seems.
Yes. Well, what's interesting, actually, is that's one of the spots in my life that is an alternate history junction, because I had accepted a puppetry job in Philadelphia, and I was going to be gone for a year, maybe more. It might have been a permanent position, and the summer progressed and the injury was not healing, I had to call them and say, "I have to turn this down because I can't work right now." If I had gone, who knows what would have happened if we would have wound up getting married.
Wow. That's really scary, getting that kind of injury when it interferes with your livelihood as well. That must have been awful.
It was, although I had a wonderful, really wonderful occupational therapist who made a clamshell cast for me so I could take it off when absolutely necessary, although, of course, was told not to. But more importantly, the part that went over my palm, she made as thin as possible. So I had pretty good movement in my hands, and then I was able to still, I fortunately am ambidextrous when puppeteering, so I had a couple of things that I was booked for, and so I was puppeteering left-handed, and having just enough movement in my fingers allowed me to still handle the puppet. I couldn't rotate, my arm was such that I couldn't turn my hand over.
Ooh, how awful.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite show or a favorite puppet?
You know, people ask this one, and I should really come up with a lie to tell them, because they want me to have one. But it's like saying, do you have a favorite child? Do you have a favorite book that you've written? You know, they're all good at what they do. Puppets are very much purpose-built, and they're so specific to their task that taking them out of that is difficult. I mean, my favorite show is actually still probably Little Shop of Horrors, even with that horrible story. I wound up doing several productions of it after I healed. There's a certain masochistic joy from being able to sling 125 pounds of puppet around on stage. And the music's great. I also have a puppet from Hans Christian Andersen's Snow Queen, and probably all of the puppets from that show. And they're made to look as if they are paper.
Oh.
Well, actually, most of the puppet itself is paper. The clothes just look like they're paper. But Hans Christian Andersen did paper cuttings as he was writing his story. Part of his process was that he would come downstairs at whoever's home he was staying at, and he would tell them the story and do a paper cutting at the same time. And then when he finished telling the story, he would unfold the paper cutting and show it to them.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's you know, by all accounts, it was an amazing thing. And so when we did the Snow Queen, we worked with that partly because it tied directly into Hans Christian Andersen, but also because it very much spoke to kind of the ephemeral nature of love and how it could be something that was both enduring and incredibly fragile.
The Snow Queen is one of my all-time favorite fairy tales, actually.
Oh, it's a beautiful one.
It's gorgeous. So that's interesting hearing about his process. I was wondering if there's any kind of interaction between your puppeteering and the novel writing. In lots of cases with lots of writers I know, we're role players, and the skills we learnt as GMs kind of helped with storytelling. Mm. And obviously there's, you know, the cornerstone of what you do as a puppeteer is storytelling as well. Does one feed into the other, or are they just too different?
They very much feed into each other. In fact, when I'm teaching writing, I use a lot of the vocabulary from puppetry to talk to people about how to develop a character that the audience can relate to, and getting the audience to connect with what's happening on the stage, or page, as the case may be. There's basically four principles of puppetry, and each of them kind of maps very, very nicely onto writing. But one of the ones that's kind of surprising within them is there's the idea of meaningful movement, which is the idea that every time your character moves, it needs to mean something.
Mm.
Because puppets and characters in books have a surprising commonality in that they have very limited facial expression. You know, I can describe, you know, the character's eyebrow rose at a 45-degree angle and his lip curled, but it lacks any sort of passion. Whereas full body movements are very easy to read. And so, like, the example that I do when I'm teaching is a training phrase from puppetry, which is, what did you say? And in puppetry, we talk about aggressive, passive, and regressive motion. So an aggressive motion is anything you're curious about, anything you lean in towards, like I'm leaning across this little coffee table. And then passive is, you know, sitting up very nicely. And then regressive is anything that you're not interested in, so that you lean back, you move away from, you turn, and anything you don't want to engage with, certain types of fear. So if you take "what did you say," which is our training phrase, and then you apply a piece of body language to it, it tells you how the character is saying it. It tells you a great deal about the character's facial expression and allows the reader to fill in everything around it. So, you know, "what did you say? The principal opened the drawer and set the paddle on the table," versus, "what did you say? She leaned away from the giant speakers blaring punk rock music into her ears."
Mm.
And so that gives you a lot, and allows you to shape the context of the language in ways that are useful on the page or on the stage.
Mm, that's wonderful. Oh, well, I'm looking at this teapot, and I'm afraid it's empty.
Oh, sorry, that might be my fault, because it's really lovely.
And the bath buns are nothing but little crumbles and specks of sugar now. I'm afraid that we're going to have to land and help you onto the other rock, which is going to fly you back to Chicago.
Well, thank you.
It's been such a delight to have you here today. Thank you for coming on this lovely flight with us.
Oh, thank you. This has been I think I can safely say, a unique experience.
Oh, but there's something I wanted to ask you before you go. Now, I have a memory of you mentioning something about a special edition of your Glamorous Histories coming out in the UK. Is that right?
That is correct. In the UK, the version of Shades of Milk and Honey that is coming out is 2 chapters longer than the American version.
I didn't imagine it.
No.
This is splendid. When is that coming out?
That comes out October 3rd. I'm really looking forward to it. My editor made the mistake of asking me if there was anything I wanted to change, and I was like, well, yes, there is, in fact.
Funny that.
There are other changes throughout the book, but yes, two additional chapters.
Wow, you're so lucky to be able to go back and change, because I think it's one of the curses of being a writer, looking back at books we've written some time before and always wanting to pull our sleeves up and get back in there and tinker. But I'm really looking forward to that, because the third book has come out in hardback but not paperback yet.
Is that correct? Right. Yes.
Yep. Wonderful. So I will look forward to that in October, and we'll be seeing you over in Dear Blighty in October as well, won't we?
Yes, we will. I'm so looking forward to that. Although I suspect my travel there will not be nearly as pleasant.
Well, it's a little bit tricky when it comes to British airspace. They're a little fussy.
Yes.
So, we have to go to more exotic climes. And also the weather is rather inclement for flying on the back of giant rocks.
That would be somewhat sodden, wouldn't it?
It would. It really would, especially today. So, I recommend the train.
Thank you. I will keep that under advisement.
But, thanks again for coming, and I will see you in October.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Perhaps we could take Mrs. Cole home on this one, Mom.
But we'll be travelling in opposite directions, and the rock will be waiting for us. And I've arranged the most gorgeous tea and biscuits for Mary to have on the way home.
Yes, Mom. This way, Mrs. Cole.
Well, that was so lovely. We'll have to make sure the sugar from those buns is swept out before we... Latimer? Are you all right?
I do think Mrs. Cole would be more comfortable in the carriage and then a train, Mum.
Nonsense. She loved the view and it'll be much faster. Look, see how delighted she is now it's coming into land. She'll be in the howdah before you could say more tea, Vicar, and home in time for dinner.
If only she hadn't worn such a colourful gown. She wouldn't look so appetising.
Latimer, that is not appropriate.
Oh, I didn't mean to say that... I mean, not appetizing in the sense of...
Oh! It's picked her up in its claws. That wasn't supposed to happen. It was supposed to land and let her climb its wing. And where is it going? That's not the way to Chicago.
I fear it's taking her to its nest, Mom.
We have to follow it and see if we can save her.
I'll ask our rock to turn around, Mom.
Well, Mary's very calm. I think she must be unflappable. There's the nest. There's no other birds there, thank goodness. Only eggs. I think one has a crack in it. How could this have happened, Latimer?
Well, the word for home and for dinner are very similar in rock language, Mum. Just a slight variation in intonation. I feel terrible. Had I known she was so marvellous...
Well, surely that wouldn't make any difference to the way you'd pronounce a word, would it?
No, Mum.
It's dropped her and the tea and biscuits next to the egg with the crack in it. I wonder where it's flying to now. At least it's not going to stop us going near.
The egg is hatching, Mum. The chick will eat her. This is disastrous. Quite disastrous.
Now, Latimer, keep it together. We need a rope or something.
I can't look.
Wait, she's making something out of her shawl and a pen case from her handbag. It's a puppet of a rock. Look, Latimer, it's going to be all right. Mary is feeding the chick biscuits with the puppet, and it's imprinting on her. She's going to be fine.
I feel slightly unwell, Mum.
It's all fine. Look, the chick loves her. It's just like that languages panel at Worldcon all over again.
She fed the audience biscuits using a puppet, Mum?
No, I just meant that they loved her. Oh, never mind. Look, she's seeing if the chick is strong enough to fly her down to the carriage she arrived in.
I think I heard her call it George. A fine name. And he looks like a sturdy fellow. There they go. What a relief. She waved to me, Mum. Goodbye, Mrs. Cole.
Latimer, she was just shaking out her shawl. I think you need to get the rock to take us home, don't you?
Very good, Mum.
As Latimer arranges our ride home, hopefully with the correct pronunciation, I'd like to thank you for joining the supremely talented Mary Robinette Kowal and I today. Both Mary and I will be attending BristolCon on October 26th, and it would be a delight to see you there too. World Fantasy Con will be the week after, and that will be the last event of the year for me. Dear listeners, I'm already looking at next year's schedule and was wondering if you could be so kind as to let me know which conventions you plan to attend next year. I'm definitely attending Nine Worlds and Worldcon in London, back to back, which will be a study in stamina, but nothing else is firmly booked yet. Do be dears and pop over to www.tnjeopardy.com and let me know in the comments over there. Well, until next time, my toffee bonbons. Now, Latimer, once we've landed, I think you need to have a stiff drink and the rest of the day off. Then could you find a new location for the secret tea there? Perhaps somewhere that doesn't involve claws?
Very good, Mum.
You've just listened to an episode of Tea and Jeopardy, hosted by Emma Newman. Go to www.tnjeopardy.com to find out more and join in.